This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. I'm broadcasting live, statewide, from my basement right now. Kind of amazing. I've been working from home all week, and our team hasn't missed a beat, though we haven't seen each other in weeks. We'll continue to do so as long as it takes. But I, like many of us, am really looking forward to everything getting back to normal. Until then, we'll continue not only our coverage of the coronavirus, but also some diversions. We've gotten messages from listeners requesting other kinds of content, and we hear you. For example, we're planning a springtime show for next week on birds we might begin to see in our backyards now that we're spending more time at home. We're going to keep at it, and thank you for listening. We're going to start things off today like we do every Friday with a roundup of Indiana's biggest news stories of the week from our digital producer, Lauren Chapman, who's joining me live from our flagship station in WFYI in Indianapolis. Lauren, can you hear me?
I can totally hear you. How's it going?
It's so weird not to be sitting across the desk from you, as I prefer, because you are such a bright and wonderful presence in my life and in our listeners' lives. But we're going to do the best we can with what we've got, right?
I can't imagine that's true in any way, shape, or form, but we're doing the thing.
So, all right. So we got some sobering numbers this week. What are the numbers as of last night?
Yeah, so as of last night, the state of Indiana has 3,437 confirmed cases of COVID-19. And yesterday also marked us reaching a milestone. We are now over 100 deaths from the outbreak, 102 to be specific. And 17,835 Hoosiers have been tested. And just for context, at this point last week, we'd only had 981 confirmed cases. We were only at 24 deaths, and only about 7,000 folks had been tested. So testing is growing consistently, and it's still very much targeted. Even from last week to this week, though, that net has widened considerably. People are hospitalized, healthcare workers, first responders, and frontline essential workers like grocery store cashiers, and now symptomatic people who are in high-risk categories, including pregnant women. But if you don't fall into those categories, even if your primary care provider thinks that you have COVID-19, you still might not get tested.
So what has the state response been?
Yeah, there have been a couple of big things this week. And first and foremost, it was Indiana school buildings were announced to close. So schools will be required to close or will be closed for the rest of the academic year. The state superintendent of public instruction, Jennifer McCormick, announced that alongside the governor yesterday. And so there were a ton of things attached to that announcement. First and foremost, schools will be required to complete at least 160 instructional days for the school year unless granted an additional waiver. And usually school years have to provide instruction for at least 180 days. High school seniors will have final graduation exams completely waived, and they will also receive credit toward receiving their diplomas for courses they've enrolled in for the spring semester, as long as they've met the distant learning participation requirements set by their school. But they do not have to pass those courses. And then the biggest thing that I noticed from McCormick's remarks and from the reporting of our education reporter, Jeannie Lindsay, and Brandon Smith, our State House reporter, was the acknowledgement that this environment that isn't an environment to educate kids, right? Like, you know, as beneficial as distance or virtual or e-learning can be for 1 or 2 day closures, especially for weather, we're weeks into this now. And McCormick said not all school districts or families have the capacity for distance or virtual learning. And that was something that was really hit hard in the announcement yesterday.
Yeah, that was a concern, I think, of a lot of people as this all came together. Now, employment is another big news item. The unemployment numbers are continuing to rise. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so the third week of March had 62,000 unemployment claims, which is mind-boggling. But last week, the fourth week of March, there were 120,000 unemployment claims, which means that 3.5% of the state's entire labor force applied for benefits last week, which is totally mind-boggling. But it's also very much indicative of the impact that social distancing is having on our labor force. And then...
And of course...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. We are fighting a bit of a delay here in this system. I'm broadcasting from my basement. You're in the studio there, and I guess the next item is how it affects the gig economy and self-employed people.
Yeah, and contract workers, and they are all still waiting for help. So the CARES Act, which is the federal piece of legislation that was passed, wow, that was last week, wasn't it? Huh. Makes self-employed workers and independent contractors eligible for pandemic unemployment assistance. And so they could get money to compensate for full or partial unemployment or an inability to work due to COVID-19. But states can't offer the benefits until they get specific information from the Federal Department of Labor. So right now, everyone's kind of in a holding pattern while the U.S. Department of Labor provides that information to states. And unfortunately, that could take a couple of weeks. So Justin Hicks, who's the workforce reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and I did a Facebook Live conversation last night, and one of the recommendations that he made was still try to file for unemployment, even if you don't think that you're going to get it, or if you think that you may be denied. Going through that process is still going to help get your name in a system in order to help move things along.
Yeah, and Justin Hicks has done some great reporting on unemployment, even leading up to COVID-19. And we're in an interesting situation right now with unemployment, since it was so low before all of this. The funding that unemployment offices have gotten has been very low, and they've had to cut back. But now unemployment has skyrocketed, and we're in a very, very different world now, and perhaps with less resources that the unemployment office has had. It's got to be a big, big challenge for them. Okay, so what is the latest on the stay-at-home order? The governor's been giving daily briefings, and has anything changed?
Yeah, so one thing to keep in mind is that the stay-at-home order actually only runs until Monday at 11:59 p.m. So we're on a bit of a deadline. Last Friday, after All In, I covered one of the governor's daily press conferences for Brandon Smith. And during that press conference, two important things were said that I found at least important. First and foremost, the state health commissioner, Chris Bach, said her best guess for when the peak of this would be is mid to late April. So they are fully anticipating a surge in cases. It's some of the things that you guys have talked about with hospitals and, other previous shows. But that's not going to happen for another couple of weeks. And then the other thing that I found interesting was the head of NDOT, the Indiana Department of Transportation, rattled off the statistic that there was a 41% decrease in traffic last week, which is all super great, right? But the governor's stay-at-home order does end on Monday at midnight, essentially. So the one thing that we're anticipating is that the governor is probably going to issue an extension of the stay-at-home order, hopefully today, but it could be as late as Monday afternoon.
Okay. And we are continuing to send out some inquiries on our Indiana 2020 two-way texting tool. Is that correct?
Yes, we are. And based on those questions, we're able to have those Facebook Live conversations like Justin Hicks and I, and Side Effects Public Media's Brittany Howell and our very own Robin Tate Rockwell did last night. So to join that conversation, text elections to 73224 to join the Indiana 2022 way, or just ask your question. In almost every single story from our reporters, you'll find a box. Leave your question in an email and we'll get back to you.
Yeah, indeed. We set up the Indiana 2022 way thinking the election would be the biggest story this year. And obviously that is not the case. So we are using the Indiana 2022 way tool to cover COVID-19 and answer any questions that you might have. Lauren, I'm just going to ask, how has your week been? Are you doing okay? Everyone around you all right?
You know, I keep getting asked that a lot by a lot of very well-meaning people, if I'm okay. I am thriving. Not being expected to touch or interact with people has been amazing for my mental health. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, it's the whole situation is scary, right? And so what I've mostly been focused on is the things that I can control, which is mostly using hand sanitizing wipes on basically every surface.
Indeed. And I am doing the same. I have admittedly been wearing the same pair of pajama pants all week, but still getting all of the important all-in work done down here in my basement. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday shows were all pre-recorded from my basement. We've had a great time. Adjusting to this, I shouldn't say we've had a great time. We've been doing okay adjusting to this. And we got a really interesting voicemail this week. It was kind of encouraging, a little goofy, from a listener named TA. Our producers heard it and they called it the voicemail of the year so far. And you know what? We encourage this kind of creativity from our listeners. Goodness knows we all need a little fun these days. So here we go. Let's hear TA's voicemail.
In these troubled times in which we find ourselves, perhaps we might benefit from a fireside chat from Winston Churchill. We face an implacable foe, both silent and invisible. It kills without distinction. We shall fight it in the grocery stores. We shall fight it in the pharmacies. We shall never surrender. A brilliant and wise woman recently gave me a bit of advice about fighting the virus. She simply said two words, keep pushing. And so I say to our gallant first responders, keep pushing. To the researchers in our laboratories, keep pushing. And most of all, to our doctors, nurses, and attendants in our intensive care units, in the heartbreaking work you will have to do and face in the days and weeks to come, keep pushing. And for all of us, advance Columbia. Preserve the Constitution for a brighter day. And long live the United States of America.
Isn't that great? Lauren Chapman. Lauren Chapman is our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, always working hard to put together all of our online coverage of all things Indiana. Lauren, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we welcome a chat with an IU med school geriatrician and researcher with the Regan Streef Institute on how the COVID-19 pandemic has changed the way Indiana nursing homes operate. I'm Matt Pelser. That's ahead in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before the coronavirus even reached the United States, we knew that among the most vulnerable were older adults. Now that it's here, it's important for family caregivers and healthcare providers to know how to best protect seniors. Our guest today is a physician and researcher with the Regan Streef Institute and Indiana University School of Medicine. She recently published a list of best practices in the Journal of Geriatric Emergency Medicine. Dr. Kathleen Unroe, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What kind of concerns are you hearing from family members?
Well, caregivers of older adults are just trying to figure out what they need to do differently now in this new world that we are all navigating. And, you know, anyone who is providing care at home for an older adult knows how much work that is to coordinate the services and supports that a person needs who has any sort of disabilities at home. But now you don't just need your plan, but you also need a backup plan. Because what if you or one of the, you know, home health aides that's helping you get sick? What do you do now? So people really need to work hard and dig into their networks and investigate services in their area to have contingency plans. And not only just of people who can help provide care, but also supplies of food and supplies of medicine as well. And so that, you know, that's what I would say for caregivers at home. For family members and loved ones of people in the nursing home, this has been a really hard time. I mean, you don't live in a nursing home unless you need help with very basic things like taking a bath or getting dressed. So, you know, you have functional disabilities, but also about half of people who live in nursing homes have cognitive disabilities as well, trouble with memory and thinking, like dementia. And so this, again, very vulnerable population. And already people who live in nursing facilities or assisted living facilities are at risk for social isolation. It's hard for them to get out and about. And that's why the community needs to come to them. And visits from church members and grandchildren are such an integral part of people's lives who live in facilities. And now that's been cut off. Very early on, nursing facilities realized how vulnerable our population was, and visitor restrictions went into effect. And so that's very difficult for families of people in nursing homes to navigate. They're trying to get creative and really trying to coach, you know, a grandparent on how to use FaceTime and other technologies like that. But they're really needing to rely on the staff and the facilities to help them communicate with their loved ones.
So while we're on the subject of older adults, how has the pandemic changed advanced care planning for people?
So advanced care planning is the process of discussing goals for your care and preferences for medical treatments. And it really is important for anyone. You know, at a minimum, we all should identify who would make healthcare decisions for us if we were unable to. So have a healthcare proxy identified and have just a few conversations with that person about your general goals for care and how aggressive of treatments you would want. So that's always been important in the nursing facility, again, because we have a population that has significant functional and cognitive impairments and a high likelihood of medical complications that could require medical decision-making, it's important to talk about what could happen in advance so that residents and their families are prepared, so that when someone develops a pneumonia or falls and has a fracture, that this isn't the first time that these things are ever being discussed. So that includes things like your code status, or whether if your heart and lungs stopped, you would want healthcare providers to attempt resuscitation and be placed on a ventilator, but also preferences around going to the hospital. There's a lot of care that we can provide in a nursing facility. We can, in almost every nursing facility, we can do IV treatments and you know, to do lab tests and do x-rays. So, you know, there are some people who would not want to go to a hospital and receive hospital level care. They would want the nursing facility to do all we could do in that place. So again, so decisions around hospitalization, there are also decisions around feeding tubes, things like that. In our current context, it is even more critical that we're having the conversation and that we're having it, you know, very honestly, because there is this increased risk of this virus in our community. And so what we want to avoid is someone getting sick very quickly and then having our default very aggressive care happening, transitioning someone to the hospital and to the ICU who never would have wanted that sort of treatment and is very unlikely to benefit from that sort of aggressive treatment. So we are doing people a disservice if we aren't very honestly having these conversations right now, not to scare people, but to address these real issues that could come up so that when something happens, it's not the first time that it's been thought about. And so myself and my colleagues at Indiana University and others across the country in palliative care are rapidly adapting materials specific to doing advanced care planning and also delivering palliative care in the setting of COVID-19.
We're on the line with Dr. Kathleen Unroe, who is a practicing geriatrician and researcher with the Regenstrief Institute. And we're talking about guidelines for older adults in long-term care facilities and nursing homes amid the COVID-19 pandemic. And of course, you are a nursing home physician, and so you see patients all the time. What is life like for them right now?
Well, so those that have insight into what is going on, are, well, they're bored, and they don't.
As are all of us.
Yeah, right. And so they're, you know, they're missing their, you know, their stream of visitors. They're missing their activities. You know, that they would gather in the dining hall and play with their friends, and they're much more confined to their rooms. And so, you know, your world is narrowed if you live in a nursing facility, but many of my residents use every inch of that space. You know, their exercise during the day is taking laps around the building and stopping to chat at the nurse's station and with their friends, or the most exercise they get is using their walker to go to the dining hall 3 times a day. And so, so not having, you know, those usual interactions, I mean, just like all of our day-to-day lives are disrupted, life in the nursing facility is disrupted and narrowed as well. And so the social isolation and also the mobility are the two things that I'm seeing that are different. Now, of course, there's a number of people, though, who have moderate to advanced dementia who don't understand what's going on, why they can't walk where they usually walk. And certainly when they, if they become symptomatic, cannot cooperate with wearing a mask and, you know, issues like that, which complicates their care. But, you know, that's where they are staff in nursing facilities is skilled at taking care of people with dementia, and those residents need extra support right now.
But are residents or staff frightened of what might happen if the virus were to make it into their facilities? What is that reality like?
Of course. I mean, and I think that's a common emotion that we are all experiencing. Nursing home leadership and you know, our state departments of health are very focused in sharing best practice guidance to be proactive. So to have nursing facilities have plans in place that if there is a positive case, what are we going to do? How can we cohort that resident and other symptomatic or positive residents in a part of the building and protect the rest of the facility? So the more prepared we are, the more that helps to address the fear part of it, as well as, you know, being smart with our personal protective equipment, having what we need and using it per the guidelines, and not more than that. In nursing facilities now, everyone's wearing a face mask, all of the providers who are doing patient care during the day. I think we're all very action focused and trying to be as prepared and focused as we can to deal with this really unprecedented challenge. I will say that frontline nursing home staff, and this goes for home health care aides too, are heroes. And I would have said that to you 6 months ago. These frontline staff spend long shifts taking care of people with so many different needs, many of whom, you know, have cognitive impairment and need a lot of support, and, you know, may not be able to say thank you, right, for this kind of very personal and intense care that they're providing, and they do it because they have connections to their residents and their clients. They care about this population, and now we always ask a lot of them, frankly, and now we're asking even more, and so I'm very grateful to the frontline nursing home staff and home health care aides who continue to come to work and provide essential care to these vulnerable residents.
I've been curious about this. Can or should care or treatment for COVID-19 positive patients be provided by nursing homes in some cases? Say someone in the facility comes down with it. Do they need to leave immediately?
We take care of sick people in nursing homes every day. We treat pneumonia. We treat urinary tract infections. We treat all kinds of illnesses in nursing facilities every day. The key to this one is the concern about transmission. So yes, we have the capabilities to treat COVID-19 in nursing facilities, the if being that there is a plan to have this person isolated from the rest of the community and have dedicated staff and have appropriate equipment. And in that situation, absolutely, yes, we can take care of COVID-19 residents. And that's happening right now in Indiana.
What about, you recently did an article on transfers between nursing homes and hospitals. How has that changed amid the pandemic?
Well, nursing home residents, because of their many medical issues, frequently transfer to the hospital. So in a given year, about a quarter of long-stay nursing home residents will end up in an emergency department at some point. So, so now, we are really focused on these transfers. So this has been an area of my colleagues and my work for a long time. How can we reduce these transfers when we can? How can we make these transfers as safe as possible? And now this pandemic is shining a bright light on these transfers. And yes, I was very happy to collaborate with another geriatrician and some emergency department doctors and thinking, you know, really hard about what's most important. And the most important thing is a warm handoff. So direct communication between the providers in the nursing facility who are sending someone out with the emergency department physician who's going to receive that person. And certainly the EMS provider who is going to transport them. Any concerns or symptoms where there's suspicion of COVID-19 need to be clearly shared. But also, we can't have any patients for information getting lost. Like, that happens all the time, that someone has very clear goals of care, and somehow between the nursing home and the hospital, that information gets lost or wasn't sent or, you know, gets dropped along the way, or the medication list, or, you know, or these other incredibly key pieces of information. And we can't have any tolerance for that right now. That, you know, we have to be so efficient and clear. And in order to provide people the best care, honor their preferences, we have to make sure information travels where it needs to travel. And so the warm handoffs, the phone calls, the, you know, direct, you know, conveying of information is really critical right now.
Dr. Unruh, you formed a nursing home care startup called Probari. How does your model for care differ from what's currently in play?
Well, so we have a CMS clinical demonstration project called Optimistic. And we started that back in 2012. It's hard to believe it's been 7 years. But in this model of care, we've embedded additional RNs and NPs and nurse practitioners in nursing facilities in the central Indiana area to see if, with the specialized roles that we created, we could reduce overall hospital transfers. So the role of these RNs and NPs touches on some of the things that we've discussed here, including high quality, proactive, advanced care planning, safe transitions of care, and recognizing an acute change in status and getting a plan of care in place quickly. So that's the kind of work we've been doing. And we've had really good results. There's been a national evaluation of these various demonstration projects, and our site had excellent results. We reduced potentially avoidable hospital transfers overall by about a third. And so a couple years ago, I did found a company called Probari Inc. And our goal is to disseminate the successful Optimistic clinical care model to provide an enhanced layer of support to nursing facility staff with the goal of providing high quality care in place and reducing transfers. So we're working with nursing facilities in Michigan and in Ohio and excited to really spread the work we've been doing for years in Indiana. in this moment in time, our, you know, small Probari team, because I have my full-time role at the university as a researcher and a practicing physician. And so Probari is a small healthcare startup, but we have, the people working in this startup, this is our area of expertise. How can we help support nursing facilities to deliver high quality care in place? And I'm so pleased that we've been able to partner with the Indiana State Department of Health to have some of our nurses support the outreach that Indiana State Department of Health nurses are doing to support nursing homes right now. So just add some added strength and workforce to the efforts they already have going on in terms of reaching out to nursing facilities, making sure they know the latest on best practice related to COVID-19 and providing any kind of support we can right now.
Dr. Kathleen Unroe is a research scientist at the IU Center for Aging Research at Regan Streef Institute. She's also an associate professor of medicine at IU School of Medicine and a practicing geriatrician. Kathleen, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Matt.
Up next, Indiana's primary is moving to June 2nd because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We talked to Bill Morrow, co-founder of the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation, about how that may affect voter participation and whether it may push forward efforts to loosen restrictions on absentee voting in Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. So how is voter participation in Indiana? Two words, not great. Last year, the Indiana Civic Health Index showed that in the 2016 election, we were 41st in the nation for participation, 43rd for the 2018 midterm. And here we are in 2020, another big election year, but with a very different kind of problem. The COVID-19 pandemic has postponed the May primary until June 2nd, and it's gotten a lot of people talking about other ways we could do this. Joining me now is the co-founder of the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation, Bill Morrow. Hi, Bill.
Matt, how are you?
Well, I mean, I'm okay. How are you? Are you doing okay?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, our family, we're all safe and healthy. Sounds like yours are too. And although certainly as the days go by, I guess everybody is now being affected in some way. Somebody knows somebody who's had it. And so these are certainly challenging times.
Indeed. Well, we did a whole show with you back in November about the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation, but I think it's good to reiterate some of that. Those numbers that came out last year in the Civic Health Index were really sobering. Why does turning those statistics around mean so much to you?
So it forms the our reason for being. We were founded to increase the number of informed Hoosier voters. That's why we exist, and that's what we're working on. We're trying to get Indiana from the bottom 10 to the top 10 of states for turnout and to connect Hoosier voters to a source of unbiased information about the candidates and the issues.
So now this pandemic has brought with it a new set of problems. The primary is being postponed. What was your reaction when you heard about that?
Well, I was pleased. We supported the decision by the governor, secretary of state, the two party chairs, and on into the Indiana Election Commission. It took a lot of courage, actually, to move it. This was controversial within both political parties, right? I mean, candidates were putting together their campaign plans based upon a May primary, and then that just got moved out a month. So you can be sure that the Republican chairman, Kyle Hupfer, and the Democratic chair, John Zodi, caught some flack from some in their party. And so it took some courage. It was absolutely the right thing to do.
And so this can pave the way for a new kind of voting, maybe not for May or June, but it's certainly gotten people thinking about how can we vote if we can't get together and we can't go to a place and we can't all kind of stand in line, as we certainly couldn't right now. And what kind of voting is that?
Well, right. So the primary is going to be conducted through absentee voting. So whether you call it no-fault absentee voting or no-excuse absentee voting, we prefer to call it absentee voting for all, right? You'll be able to apply for a ballot, apply for an absentee ballot. In fact, the Secretary of State's office very quickly changed that form and eliminates, you know, the place on the form where you have to fall into one of those categories. We've already posted it on our website, indianacitizen.org, and it'll be broadly available. So you go in and you print out that form and you sign it and you send it back to the county clerk. And if you are, in fact, a valid registered voter, you'll get an absentee ballot in the mail. And then you have to fill that out and return it by mail. That's what absentee voting is.
And Indiana had a good bit of restrictions on absentee voting, some of the most restrictive in the nation, as I understand it. What were some of those? What were some of the obstacles people had up until now to participate in absentee voting?
Well, you had to fit into one of 12 categories, and so that's been eliminated. But if you look inside the Secretary of State's reports, Matt, you will see that the number of ballots cast in the fall, in the November election, by absentee has been climbing. So Hoosiers are getting more and more accustomed to using the absentee method to vote.
Do you think that no-fault absentee voting or no-excuse absentee voting would increase turnout?
So, look, if you're asking about increasing turnout in the upcoming June primary, I think we're going to see, and many people who study this more carefully than I do, I think we're inevitably headed to a pretty low turnout in June. I mean, just the communications challenges and the logistical challenges here. So there'll be some number of primary voters who regularly vote absentee, but the vast majority do not. And so there's going to be quite a challenge ahead of the parties to make sure that the word is out, that this is the way, this option is available to you. Because this begs the question of whether there will be any in-person voting in the upcoming June primary, whether there'll be any in-person voting. And, you know, there are those who believe, I think correctly, that there needs to be some amount of in-person voting. You think of people with disabilities and others who, really would be disenfranchised if they can't vote in person. So the Indiana Election Commission, ably chaired by Paul Okeson the vice chair is Anthony Long. They've got some challenges ahead of them between now and April 22nd to figure out what the final rules are going to be for the June 2nd primary.
What's happening on April 22nd?
The Indiana Election Commission is going to have a public hearing, right? When they met a couple of weeks ago to decide to move the primary, it wasn't a hearing in the sense, it was a meeting, but it wasn't a hearing in the sense of being able to take testimony from the public. So on April 22nd, the Indiana Election Commission will meet, will have a hearing. So the public will be able to comment on the changes and they'll be able to, you know, hear about whether or and how much in-person voting should be conducted on June the 2nd.
And another reason I would imagine that the primary numbers may be low, or the fact that the big races, governor and president, are pretty much already determined. We know who the candidates are going to be there. So are you going to take any, cue from the primary turnout as to being able to gauge your success with the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation? Are you going to kind of try to throw those numbers out as a variable?
So, right. It's useful, of course, to remember why the primary elections exist. The primary elections exist for the parties to nominate their candidates. So, yes, turnout, we think, and many people think, is going to be low. But for purposes of the Indiana Citizen Project, we have never been looking toward the primary as a place where we're going to try to promote registration and turnout. Our focus has always been on the fall.
We recently did a show with the president and vice president of the nonprofit Indiana Vote by Mail, and the show blew up. We got a lot of engagement from listeners who have moved here from other states that have more comprehensive vote by mail strategies. You can go back and listen to that in the podcast.
I have listened to it. It was a great show.
It was a great conversation. What are some of the obstacles in place for getting a more comprehensive vote by mail strategy done for Indiana?
Well, it would take an act of the legislature.
For one thing.
Well, you're right. I mean, for those who are thinking about pure vote by mail in the fall, it's probably true that, you know, the prevailing legal view is that the governor, the secretary of state, and the election commission have some authority, which they are exercising in order to move the primary and to have absentee voting for all. I haven't looked at the legal question of whether in the fall, the November election could be moved to true mail-in voting without the legislature acting on it.
Sure. But what is the difference, I guess, between so-called pure vote by mail, what states like Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Utah have, and what we have, this sort of this absentee voting system, which is sort of moving toward a no-fault absentee voting system? What's the difference?
Well, it begins with the absentee voting for all is a two-step process. First, you get a document, a form that you fill out to request an absentee ballot, and the absentee ballot is sent to you, and then you send that back. So it's a two-step process. True vote by mail is every registered voter gets in their mailbox a ballot that you fill out and send back.
And the challenges of that are, among other things, keeping the voter rolls purged and clean. I would imagine that's maybe at the top of the list.
Well, that's part of it, right? And you have to build in some safeguards in the process to make sure that the right people are getting it and the right people are filling it out, and the right people are sending it back. So there are some complexities associated with mail-in voting, but this much is absolutely indisputable. The states that have mail-in voting tend to rank at the top 10 of states for turnout, right? It does improve turnout.
Can the debate, though, around getting a pure vote by mail system, can that debate be partisan in any way?
Well, I think if you had that debate today, it would certainly be less partisan, right? I mean, so I think the governor, secretary of state, the election commission, and the political parties are going to take a look at what's going to happen in June 2nd, and they're going to see what effect it's had on participation and ought to have a discussion, okay, begins with what's the public health environment at the moment, right? Let's pray that the public health crisis has passed. So we don't have to have an Indiana discussion about mail-in voting any sooner than we need to. I mean, meaning we'd have a traditional election in November. Those who want to vote absentee need to vote absentee, do that. Those of us who vote in person, we vote in person.
And again, we talked in November last, and a lot has happened since then. I want to talk about some of the progress that you've made since then. Your main goal is to move Indiana from the bottom 10 to the top 10 of states for voter participation and registration for this year's big election in November. How's it coming? How have we done since then?
Well, we've made some real progress. At the end of 2019, we received a very generous grant that permitted us to hire our first full-time employee. His name is Kevin Morgan. He spent most of his career at the Indianapolis Star. The last part of his career, he was at the Legislative Services Agency, so sort of at the nerve center, the information nerve center for the General Assembly and the state. When he was at the Star, Kevin was in charge of their voter guides. So what we hope to produce under Kevin's leadership is the best voter guide that Indiana's ever seen, all digital, of course.
Yeah, and what's that going to look like? How's that going to go?
Well, you know, you can't see my fingers crossed here, but, you know, our hope is that we're going to build these candidate profiles. We're going to build information about the issues that is completely unbiased. And here, my fingers are really crossed. If we can get this technology to work, people who come through our website and leave us information about them, that would be at indianacitizen.org. We'll be able to reach back to them before the general election and send them an electronic version of their ballot, of their individual ballot. They'll be able to see the names of who's going to be on their ballot when they vote, click on those names, and go to unbiased information about those candidates. And that's never been done.
Part of having a nonprofit is raising money. Not so easy these days. How has that part been going?
Well, look, so the stock market has crashed. So let's see, if you think about who our donors are, they are individuals, they are foundations, and they would be corporations. So, you know, everybody's been hit by it. So it's a special round of challenges in fundraising, right? One of our major foundation supporters and I had a conversation yesterday, and the conversation went like, you know, we need to focus on basic human needs in 2020. Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. Had some wealthy individuals who gave in 2019 who are not as wealthy today as they were when they gave in 2019. I understand that completely. You know, corporations have had their stock price damaged and aren't getting you know, revenue in the door. So yeah, we're trying to raise about $3 million in a very, very challenging environment, but we're gonna keep at it.
Yeah, all of that considered, I mean, the fact that we are all in the same boat now, would you say, with all of those variables in place, that to the best of your ability, you're on track?
Yes, on track. Look, we have raised to date about $500,000 from our start, and that's reason to be proud. But that still leaves us $2.5 million to raise in order to do the registrations that we need. Right? I mean, we need to go out. We need to find fellow Hoosiers who are unregistered, connect with them, provide them a pathway to get registered, and stay in touch with them. That's an expensive proposition.
So what about after 2020? It's a tough question when these days a week seems like a month, but what do you plan to do after November of this year?
Having spent some time in politics, right, there's some superstition that comes along with planning after an election. So look, we're going to work as hard as we can to be successful in 2020, and then it'll be up to our funders. Did we add value? Did we improve our registration and turnout in Indiana? Did we provide an unbiased source of information?
Bill Morrow is co-founder of the Indiana Citizen Education Foundation. Bill, thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you, Matt. Please invite me back at any time. And in the meantime, everybody go to indianacitizen.org.
All right. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Catch up if you have some extra time. And stay with this station for statewide coverage from our Indiana Public Broadcasting News team. I can't say it enough. They're all rock stars. On Monday, we'll talk about the impact the coronavirus pandemic has had on Indiana's small businesses. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and have a great weekend. This is All In.